This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Well, the future may be brighter than we think. What if the energy transition is arriving faster than anyone imagined? And what if paying attention to the smallest things can change how we live? This Earth Day, I revisit my interview with Bill McKibben about Here Comes the Sun, a bracing and hopeful argument that cheap, abundant solar power could reshape geopolitics, weaken authoritarianism, and help us meet the climate emergency. Then Anne Fadiman turns our attention from planetary systems to intimate acts of noticing. In her essay collection, Frog, she finds wonder and moral inquiry in a neglected pet frog, the burden of literary inheritance, pronouns, grammar, and other seemingly modest subjects that open into large human questions. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. This Earth Day, we begin with a measure of hard-won hope. The disruption to global oil supplies from the Iran war is adding urgency to the transition away from fossil fuels. And even though Donald Trump wiped out federal incentives for solar energy, many states are stepping into the breach. That makes this conversation even more timely than when we recorded it last November. We spoke with climate activist and author Bill McKibben about his book, Here Comes the Sun, A Last Chance for the Climate and a Fresh Chance for Civilization. It's one of the most hopeful books McKibben has written, arguing that the plummeting cost of solar and wind could transform not just our energy system, but global politics itself, not just power, but a democratic alternative to the fossil fuel order. Let's listen now. Bill McKibben, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
What a pleasure to be with you, friend.
This is a wonderful new book of yours, Here Comes the Sun, A Last Chance for the Climate and a Fresh Chance for Civilization. You open the book with the remarkable line that for the first time, you can see a path forward, a path lit by the sun. What led you from decades of what I assume is climate disappointment to this new sense of possibility?
Well, in some ways, it's all about realism. The problem always with the climate fight has been that the thing that causes the climate crisis, burning fossil fuel, is also the thing that's long undergirded our economy. So it was very difficult to imagine the path to changing as fast as physics demands. About 5 years ago, we crossed some invisible line where it became cheaper to generate power from the sun and the wind than from burning coal and gas and oil. And that suddenly opened up extraordinary possibilities. Suddenly, we had a scalable tool in this fight. And it's been remarkable over the last 36 months to watch that surge start to happen around the world. That's why I wanted to write this book, to document that moment and let people know that there was a real possibility. We're seeing a faster energy transition than we've ever seen before with any fuel. The world is producing a third more energy from the sun this fall than it was last fall. That gives you some sense of how we've hit the steep part of the S-curve. It isn't fast enough yet to catch up with the physics of climate change. And we're not going to stop global warming. That's not on the menu of options. But we may be able to shave tenths of a degree off how hot the world gets. And every tenth of a degree that the planet heats moves another 100 million people out of a safe climate zone and into a dangerous one. So this remains incredibly important work.
You've said that solar is the Costco of energy, cheap and abundant, not the Whole Foods of energy. Why do you think that that reality hasn't sunk in with people. People still think that it's too expensive for them.
Well, A, I think we've spent 40 years calling it alternative energy, and that's where it sort of got filed away in our brains. And B, the costs are different than they are with fossil fuel. With solar energy, the cost is upfront. You have to put up the panels. With fossil fuel, the cost is perennial. You just keep writing a check every month for more fuel. And over time, it's obviously much cheaper to let the sun deliver energy for free. But we need ways to finance that and make it easy to get the initial capital investment made. So that's why it's, a little daunting for people. But we can change that. We're working hard to lower the permitting boundaries. That's why solar panels cost 3 times as much in this country as in the EU or Australia. We've got too much bureaucracy in the way. And happily, there are lots of ways to bring that down. Apps that allow municipalities to provide instant permitting, for instance, that we're working hard on. So hopefully it'll get easier and easier. It's already cost effective, but the lower we can drive the price, the more people will be able to take advantage of it.
Yeah, and it is a remarkable story. I'm talking about how much cheaper things are elsewhere. Tell us about the case of Pakistan and how countries are leapfrogging over the fossil fuel age.
Yes, so Pakistan is an interesting case. No country's been hit harder by the climate crisis. Record flooding in 2010 and 2022. Summertime temperatures in the cities that now increasingly reach the 120-degree mark. But Pakistan's geographic advantage is a long border with China. So Pakistanis fed up with an expensive and unreliable electric grid, about 2 years ago started importing huge quantities of solar panels from China. It's not a government program. This is just people putting them on rooftops, factories, warehouses, malls, everything, basically using YouTube videos as a guide to how to do it. But happily, this is pretty simple technology, and that's been working remarkably well. Pakistani farmers were an early adopter of this. Diesel for the pumps that they use to irrigate their fields are often the biggest item of expense in their budgets. So they were eager to get solar panels to do the same thing. They often lacked the money to build the metal supports we're used to seeing. So they would just lay the panels down in the field and point them at the sun. And, last year, Pakistanis used 35% less diesel to generate power than they had the year before.
And you call 2024 a breakout year for renewables. You cite both California and China. I want to drill down a little bit more with China a little bit later. Tell us about California. What has California been able to accomplish?
California's put up enough solar panels and things that they've reached some kind of tipping point. Most days now, for long stretches of the day, they're providing 100% of the power that they need from renewable sources. At night, when the sun goes down, batteries that have been soaking up excess sunshine all afternoon are often the biggest source of supply to the grid. All in all, California is using 30% less natural gas to produce electricity than they were just 2 years ago. Those are huge shifts in what is, after all, the world's fourth largest economy. So it's a sign that we can get things done. California is now, interestingly, being surpassed by Texas at the rate of clean energy installation. Even though it's obviously the headquarters of the world's hydrocarbon industry, Texas can't deny the compelling economics of sun and wind and batteries. And so they've been installing them at a ferocious pace.
Another point that you make, Bill McKibben, in this book, Here Comes the Sun, is that energy from the sun isn't just cheap. It's diffuse. It's available everywhere. So tell us how that might reshape global power structures, especially between the global north and the global south.
Well, think for a minute about, just think about, what the last 100 years of geopolitics would have looked like if during that period, oil had been of trivial value. Think how many wars and coups and assassination attempts and terrorist plots and stuff we would have averted if everybody was just able to provide this necessary commodity from the sun and wind that soaked their own countries. I find it incredibly liberating to contemplate that kind of world.
And you link that to undermining authoritarianism.
So, you know, who was the first big plutocrat or oligarch in our modern world? John D. Rockefeller, who figured out early on that if you controlled the supply of a scarce commodity, you'd be a rich and powerful human being. A lot of others learned the same trick. So now we have, you know, oil and gas barons in our country. The biggest were the Koch brothers, who spent their money eroding our democracy. In Europe, the biggest is Vladimir Putin, who's used his winnings from the fossil fuel casino to finance a ground war in Europe in the 21st century. As long as you depend on something that's only available in a few places, the people who control those few places will be more powerful than they should be. So it'd be nice to end that.
And you also say that, you know, we're turning to the heavens for energy instead of to hell, given that fossil fuels are underground. You envision a more humane geopolitics powered by the sun, and that it represents not just a technological change, but you say a moral and even a spiritual one. So go a little deeper for us in explaining this moral and spiritual dimension.
You know, I just got back from Rome, where I got to see Pope Leo. It was the 10th anniversary of Laudato Si, Francis's encyclical on global warming. And Pope Leo was explaining that he was continuing that work because it was so central to trying to help the poorest and most vulnerable people on this planet. Think about Africa, where there's 700 million people without access to electricity. Fossil fuel has done nothing for them in its 250 years. They're going to get their first energy from village-scale solar microgrids that are now going up in large number across East and West Africa as that technology flows along the Chinese trade routes that are pretty well established in those regions. That's a remarkable story.
We've alluded to the fossil fuel industry and its resistance at a time when, as you pointed out, they basically have captured the control of our federal government, lining up behind President Trump. How much could the political backsliding in the U.S. do to damage the global climate transition?
I don't think it will damage the global climate transition all that much. If anything, it's possible that it'll be easier for the rest of the planet to make progress without the U.S. in the way at global climate talks and things, because our political dysfunction has always been a big part of the obstacle to significant action. I do think that it runs the high probability of wrecking our economy. I think that, you know, America has basically transferred technological and economic primacy, and with it probably political primacy, to China in the course of the last 9 months. And as an American, that annoys me because these are things that were invented here. The first solar cell at Bell Labs in 1954, the first commercial wind turbine down the mountains from me in Vermont in the 1940s. We should be owning these technologies and the prosperity that they will create. Instead, you know, we're just doing favors for the oil guys who sent money to Trump's campaign.
You argue that the barriers to change are no longer technical or even financial, because it's the cheapest form of energy is from the sun and the second cheapest is wind. But you say that renewables are, quote, almost too cheap for capitalism. And it seems to me that this is really at the heart of the problem. It is not the kind of profit center that the fossil fuel companies are used to. So I wonder if you could address that. And then what is our way out of that?
Well, yes. I mean, the head of Exxon said last year that his company was never going to invest in renewable energy because it didn't offer as he put it, above average returns for our investors, which is true. I mean, you can get rich putting up solar panels. There will be solar billionaires, but you can't get, you know, Exxon rich, because once the solar panel is up, the sun delivers the energy for free. And from Exxon's point of view, that's the silliest possible business model. From everyone else's point of view, it's the best possible business model. So we need to make it easy for people and countries to realize those possibilities and get this equipment in place so they can start saving money in large quantities. And that's a lot of the work that we're engaged in right now.
Another obstacle is that energy demand is skyrocketing, largely because of the AI and Bitcoin investments that are, huge consumers of energy. This is driving up electricity prices, which is making it more costly to transition to decarbonization of the home, for example. It's hard to convince people to put in heat pumps. They're afraid the electricity prices are going to skyrocket. What is your answer to them?
Well, I mean, I'm agnostic about whether or not we're going to need that much power for AI or not. I think a fair amount of it may turn out to be hype and bubble. But if you're determined to build power quickly for new data centers, the only way to do it is with sun and wind, because that's the only thing that can go up quickly. It takes a long time to build a gas-fired power plant, a nuclear power plant, whatever. But we can build solar and wind farms almost overnight, which is a very good idea for lots of reasons, not least of which the skyrocketing price of energy. Electric bills are up about 10% around this country this year. That's what happens when you increase demand and at the same time constrict supply by, say, shutting down wind farms that are 90% complete, or canceling plans, as the Trump administration did last week, for the largest solar project in the country, 6.2 gigawatts slated for the Nevada desert. You don't need to be a PhD in economics to know that when you raise demand and constrict supply, prices will go up. All the more reason for people to have some of their own supply coming off the roof and to have highly efficient appliances like heat pumps to replace the furnace that we're using now.
So let's move to the activism side. You've already talked about Sunday. I'm going to attend a meeting tonight that is being put on by Third Act, which is one of the organizations you founded. It's called Make Solar Simple, Training and Campaign Launch. So tell us about this campaign.
Well, it's all about this effort to make the permitting of solar power so much easier. So we're not spending three times what they do in EU or Australia. And that can be done at the state and local level, even with the federal government in very contrary hands. And it can be done in red states as well as blue. You know, the biggest success we've had this year might have been what happened in that progressive bastion, Utah, where the state legislature unanimously improved what we're calling balcony solar, designed for apartment dwellers, a solar panel you just hang off the railing of your balcony and plug straight into your wall. No electrician, no wiring needed. That's illegal in most of the country, but not in Utah, where it was really a kind of libertarian-minded state senator who said, if this is good enough for the people of Stuttgart, surely it's good enough for the people of Provo, you know? And now they have it. You can watch hundreds of videos of happy Utahns putting up their balcony solar.
That's great. And I believe that a law has been introduced in the New York legislature.
That's exactly right. New York, New Hampshire, Vermont, Pennsylvania, place after place trying to get the same authorizing authority.
And will that make solar cheaper?
It'll make it accessible for apartment dwellers who don't have control of their roofs. So it's a very good thing.
Bill McKibben talking with us in November of 2025. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to find out about the movement bringing plug-in solar to the U.S. Next up, small creatures, big questions. Stay tuned after the break. This episode of Writer's Voice is sponsored by Larry's Coffee, exceptional coffee with a mission. Nearly all their beans are organic, fair trade, and shade grown, and their eco-friendly roasting reflects a deep commitment to sustainability. Larry's is also a certified B Corporation, showing how business can be a force for good. I've tried it. It's delicious. And every subscription through us supports Writer's Voice. Go to larryscoffee.com/voice. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. Anne Fadiman is one of the finest essayists writing in English today. Her 1997 book, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down, is a masterpiece of narrative nonfiction, and she spent years as the editor of the American Scholar. Her new collection of essays is called Frog, named for Bunky, the African clawed frog her family kept for 17 years, a creature she now realizes she didn't appreciate nearly enough while he was alive. But don't let the humble subject fool you. The essays in this collection move from a pet frog to the grammar wars over the singular they, to what it means to be the literary child of a famous literary parent, and the poetic beauty of lists. Sam Anderson of the New York Times Magazine, who wrote the foreword, says Fadiman has a gift for finding the universe hidden inside the ordinary. I think that's exactly right. And I think you're going to love this conversation. Let's listen now. Anne Fadiman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
In the foreword, Sam Anderson points to your use of lists, which I found especially intriguing because I love lists as well when they come up in literary forms. And like many of the things you talk about in this book, Frog, a list could be seen as quite a humble thing. But yours are often like little poems that focus the attention.
Well, you're so nice to say that. Sam Anderson is one of my favorite writers at the New York Times Magazine. And I was so touched by the keen attention that he paid to every aspect of my writing in his marvelous introduction. I'm not sure I can quite live up to it. But the first thing that he mentioned was lists. And in fact, he then, in honor of that, wrote his entire introduction in the form of a list. And he has me pretty well pinned. I do love lists. And you're right. I think that there is something poem-like about a list. I'm very definitely not a poet and will never be one. But if there's ever anything in a piece of creative writing, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, in which the writer has to pay attention to rhythm and sound and sequence, which of course are so important for poetry, it's a list. And that's why I like writing them. And I also like reading them.
When I was a kid, there was a very notable science fiction book called A Canticle for Leibowitz.
I remember reading A Canticle for Leibowitz as a teenager. Yes, indeed.
And it ends with a list, a grocery list. It's a post-apocalyptic, post-nuclear holocaust speculative fiction novel. And there is the canticle is a sacred text. And that sacred text turns out to be, I hate to spoil this for any of my listeners who might want to go read it, turns out to be a grocery list. Oh. So that puts one in mind how something so simple can be imbued with so much meaning. And I love your titular essay, Frog. Well, I loved all the essays in this book, but in Frog, it's about the eponymous, frog of the title, Bunky, a very small and unassuming creature. Tell us about Bunky first, and then I'll ask you a little bit more about kind of the deeper meanings of what, or the questions, the deeper questions that Bunky excited in you.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bunky was one of those pets that enter families more or less by accident rather than by choice. Families, not always, but usually think pretty hard before they get a dog. But this frog entered our family via a tadpole coupon left under a Christmas tree. We had no idea what species it was going to be. We assumed, we being my husband and I, that it wouldn't live very long because that kind of pet usually doesn't. The tadpole arrived by mail, and the frog turned out to be a species called an African clawed frog, though didn't say that in the instruction manual, and it can live essentially forever. And Bunky lived either 16 or 17 years. And the fact that we don't really know which, we know we'd had him for at least a year when we moved from New York to Massachusetts. I had his aquarium, plastic at the time, between my feet in the rented minivan, and we sloshed our way up Highway 91. So we know he was at least 16 when he died, because he was at least one at that point, but he might have been two. We, of course, remember exactly when we got our dog. So that's how Bunky entered the family. We never thought we would have him for that long. And I paid very little attention to him during his life. And one of my sources of genuine shame is that for years I planned to get him a bigger aquarium, and I never did. And I started learning about his species only after he died. Turned out he was actually quite fascinating, but I never gave him the time of day. So the essay, I guess, is about what happens to our unpettable pets.
Yeah, and also kind of ask questions about how care is not only the product of love, but the creator or the engenderer of love, that when you care, you have to care more for a pet. You end up loving that pet more, whereas, you know, Bunky was a pretty easy pet to forget in a way. And still live 17 years. You write that you were responsible enough to keep him alive, but not nice enough to make his life worth living. And it's interesting, that comes at the end of the essay. And it was like scratching an itch for me, because throughout the essay, I was thinking, poor Bunky. You know, I imagined his aquarium as being this fairly bare place. And it's only within the last few years that I even would have thought to have thought about that, because like you and like most people, I think I went through most of my life not really crediting creatures like Bunky with too much of a consciousness. So tell us a little bit about the evolution of your relationship to him, most of which happened after his death in some ways.
Yes. Well, you're absolutely right that I think caring for something develops love. And then, of course, it goes in the other direction. But one of the lists that I have in this book is a list of all of our pets ranked by ease of care, where the Bunky was the easiest, and then a hamster, and then two guinea pigs, and then our dog. Of course, the one that we loved most was the one that required the most care, and that was the dog. But I also included my children in that list, not that they were our pets, but children, of course, require far more care than any pets, and one loves them infinitely more. And I think that that is, those things are very closely related. I hadn't had any of those ideas while Bunky was alive. I was just, like many parents of young children, had my nose to the parental grindstone, and we had all these other pets who required more attention, and I was working and so on. But after he died, I guess mainly I felt guilty because his aquarium was too small, and he had two of what are called environmental enrichment products, these sort of plastic things, one of which was donut-shaped, and he ended up getting stuck in it and died in it in a kind of sad irony. So he didn't have many places to hide. It also never occurred to me until after he died and I started researching his species that he probably was very bored with his food. So he got stage one food nuggets and then stage two food nuggets from the Grow a Frog Company for his entire life. I started reading, you know, these Reddit forums from people who said, oh, my African clawed frog loves woodlice. And I thought, oh, my gosh, Bunky would have loved a woodlouse. And we never got him even one woodlouse. So guilt and shame, I guess, sort of motivating emotions. But I also started thinking about what is a pet. That is, do we require reciprocity? Do we require a pet that will wish to sit on our lap and greet us at the door and come when called? What if it's not a two-way street and our pet hardly notices us? Is it okay then if we hardly notice it? And I eventually concluded, no, that's not okay. And as you say, we were responsible pet owners in a way. We kept Bunky alive for 16 or 17 years, but we didn't make his life worth living. And I wanted to wake some of my readers up to that. And when you say that at the beginning you were thinking, poor Bunky, my goal was in the essay itself to retrace the kind of arc of the emotions that I had, where at the beginning, the essay I hope was slightly funny, and certainly Bunky seemed trivial. But by the end, when Bunky died and we buried him, I didn't want him to seem trivial. I didn't want the subject to seem trivial. I didn't want the essay to seem trivial. I was very sad when we buried Bunky.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Anne Fadiman about her acclaimed new essay collection, Frog. Now, another essay is The Oakling and the Oak, and I have to confess, I really related to this for a reason that I will reveal a little bit on. It's about Samuel Taylor Coleridge and his son Hartley, who was beloved by the poet when Hartley was an infant, but was estranged from as an adult. You reveal that Hartley was both charming and tragic. People referred to him as poor Hartley, and my heart went out to him because he really seemed to be one of these individuals who actually is far more capable than most people recognize, but he was overshadowed by the oak who was his father. He was a little oakling. His talent was quite real, but his career was shaped by expectations that he could never fully escape. One of the things you ask in this is really, what does it mean to be the child of a genius? Or if we want to call it a genius, somebody who is really notable, as Samuel Taylor Coleridge was. And how does one form an identity when one is constantly being compared with a famous parent? So talk a little bit about Hartley, tell us about him, and then let's explore what his example brings up.
Sure. Thanks for asking about him. There are only about three people in the world that I think are really experts on Hartley Coleridge. I guess I'm one of them, and it is extremely easy to be a world expert if you write about a figure as obscure as Hartley Coleridge. I've written an essay on the father, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, in my second essay collection, and I'd read a little bit about Hartley and had always been interested in him because both of my parents were writers, and I've always been interested in the writer offspring of writer parents and what makes some of them wither beneath the great oak and what makes some of them able to keep on keeping on as I did. And Hartley was exceptionally smart and really a very good poet. But it's really tough to be a poet if your father is very possibly the greatest poet in the world. The title of the essay comes from a review of the only volume of poetry that was by Hartley that was published during his lifetime, though another one was published posthumously. But in this review, the critic said that he had inherited some of his father's genius. Now, that was supposed to be a compliment, but he didn't say that Hartley had any of his own, only he'd inherited from his greater genius father. But it also quoted the old adage that the oakling always withers beneath the shadow of the oak. And as soon as I read that review, you know, online in this sort of obscure early 19th century periodical gotten online through the Yale Library, I thought, whoa, oakling, I'm an oakling, but I haven't withered. And I have ever since thought of the word oakling as meaning the writer offspring of at least one writer parent. So although I enter this essay only briefly, it was sort of like an iceberg, because beneath the surface while I was writing it was a lot of thinking about what allowed me to thrive in my family and what did not allow Hartley to thrive. And the things that did not allow Hartley to thrive, therefore, were the ones that interested me most and the ones that I chose to focus on in the essay.
Okay, so first, I'm just got to ask you, what enabled you to thrive in that situation?
Yeah, but I mean, both of my parents, you know, they're pretty big oaks. My father, Clifton Fadiman, was a critic and also well known as a radio host. And my mother was, during most of the Second World War, the only woman war correspondent in China. She perhaps was less intimidating because she gave up her career to have children, something that I wish she hadn't. I mean, she couldn't have been a war correspondent anymore. No more war, but she could have continued in journalism, but she didn't. It was very difficult, I think, for women to feel in those days that they could be good mothers and also work. But my father was well known and keeping on. But I guess both of them, they were big oaks, but they were able to move their branches so that, you know, plenty of sunlight came down, especially on me. I have an older brother, and maybe the expectations were higher on him, both as the firstborn and as the only male in this particular generation. So they made it clear that they thought very highly of me, but they never had the kind of specific expectation that people had of Hartley Coleridge, not just his father, but also the best friend, William Wordsworth, who sort of lived very nearby and who wrote very still famous poems about Hartley. So nobody was writing poems about me when I was, you know, 3 years old. It was also clear that I didn't have to be a writer. I could be anything I wished. And then I also maybe created enough separation. Once I started being a writer, I never showed either of my parents any of my work until it was published. I just wanted to be sure that no one, including me, could ever think that they'd edited it or had anything to do with it. But mainly, I think that they were not as full of themselves as Hartley's father was, and they were also just much better parents. They also stayed married, whereas Samuel Taylor Coleridge, although given the mores of the time, couldn't get divorced, essentially left his wife when Hartley was quite young, and Hartley saw him only occasionally and very confusingly when he was in his early teens, for example.
I also found very interesting Samuel Taylor Coleridge's treatment of his son, you know, in other words, coming from this perspective of the father rather than the son, because it seemed as if he projected, it's almost as if the son was, you know, that the shadow side of his father. That's how his father saw him. And then that exerted a pernicious force on the son. Talk a little bit about that.
It's so hard to know. It's a chicken and egg kind of thing. So the father was a terrible procrastinator, extremely disorganized, always in debt, always being bailed out of you know, one scrape or another by his friends. And Hartley was like that, too. And maybe that they shared the same DNA, and maybe Hartley would have been a terrible procrastinator even if he'd been adopted by another family. But the fact that the father was constantly criticizing the son for his own worst flaws without ever recognizing or acknowledging their similarity. Others outside the family did, including Wordsworth's sister Dorothy, who commented that Hartley was very like his father, especially in his weaker points. But the father simply said, "Don't do this, don't do that, you have this problem." And so he was labeling the son at such an early age with all of the things that had dogged him. And I think that we will never know what would have happened if the father hadn't done that. But they had one other similarity, possibly genetic, which was a susceptibility to addiction. And the father became an opium addict, but was more or less rescued by a nice, wealthy physician in Highgate, a wealthy then suburb of London, now really part of London, who was supposedly was going to take in Coleridge just for a short amount of time. And Coleridge ended up spending many years at this guy's house being taken care of with a certain amount of laudanum, which is opium dissolved in alcohol, being doled out to him, but not so much that he couldn't work. So this was a kind of private free rehab that Samuel Taylor Coleridge got. For Hartley, the drug of choice was alcohol. He had no private rehab, and he drank more and more, and toward the end of his life would go off on benders and be found passed out in ditches. So there was that similarity, but Hartley just didn't have as good luck and as much help as his dad did.
Yes, it is a tragic case. I related to it because I'm an Oakling also.
Oh, and which parent was your Oak?
My mother was the Oak. She was a contemporary dance choreographer. She had her own company. Mm. She merited an obituary in the New York Times. I mean, enough success to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. She was well known in her field. Mm-hmm. And I, like you, I have been defined a lot as a daughter in my life.
Yes.
And I took the tack of getting as far as possible away from anything to do with my mother's profession. Because I knew it would be, if I were successful at it, that would be very dangerous for my relationship with her. And just even going into it would have put an enormous amount of pressure on me. So I just wondered, for you, it seems like it's been pretty benign, but how have you dealt with that daughterhood issue?
Well, if there had been something else that I was really good at, I might have taken the tack that you did and gone in another direction. And my older brother, who when we were young in college and so on, was at least as good a writer as I, ended up becoming an outdoor instructor and then a commodities trader. And so two entirely different occupations, maybe because the expectations were higher on him. But I've always enjoyed writing. There didn't seem to be anything else I was all that good at. And I think it was that my parents never criticized me and were never judgmental. That is, even though my father's profession was actually to be a literary critic, when I was young, as I told you later on, when I actually became a professional writer, I never showed my parents anything until it was published. But earlier on, you know, if I would write a poem or a school essay when I was 10 and I would show it to my parents, only praise. My father would not correct the sentences. He would not correct the grammar. He knew that he had to take off the literary critic hat and give me only encouragement. And that must have been kind of hard because he probably was just itching to fix the mistakes, but he just Never did. He would when I was speaking, but never when I was writing. So I think I got the kind of unconditional, oh, wow, you're such a good writer, that I might have gotten if my parents had been dentists and I had been a writer. That is, they put their critical faculties entirely aside. And I didn't realize that at the time, but of course that turned out to be enormously freeing. Also, I went to college 3,000 miles from home, so I very much had not such an independent life because my brother went to the same college, but a life that was very independent from my parents. And in those days, long-distance calls were very expensive, so they were infrequent and short, and that was probably helpful.
Good parents.
They were.
And speaking of grammar, I think my favorite essay in this book is All My Pronouns. As a teacher of English, of course, you are concerned with grammar, and you describe yourself as, I think the term is prescriptive rather than descriptive.
Correct.
And maybe you can just briefly define that. Yeah, briefly define that, and then I'll follow up with a question.
So in grammar and usage, linguists and dictionary makers define the two main schools as the prescriptivists, who say, this is what this word means. Here's how one should use this phrase. Here are the rules of grammar. You know, subjects and verbs should agree, and so on. And descriptivists say, well, we don't care what the rules have been. Language is a moving target, and we are going to represent and simply describe language as it is used without any judgment of what's correct and what's incorrect. And I was raised in a very, very prescriptivist family and still feel prescriptivist to a certain extent, but evolved considerably about the use of the singular they, which is mostly what the essay you just mentioned, All My Pronouns, is about. And it's the only essay in this book in which I evolve in a really major way. My feelings evolved in the essay about the frog. In an essay about teaching by Zoom, I evolved from being afraid of Zoom and terrible at it to finding it could be quite warm and intimate. But my feelings about pronouns changed absolutely 180 degrees, and I now am a quite strong proponent of the singular they.
You write about a student, I mean, this began when a student of yours who was going through a transition from male to female.
Stopping in the middle at non-binary, which is why the phrase, all my pronouns. So this student, when she graduated from Yale, came up to me and gave me a big hug on commencement day and said, Anne, you've known me through all my pronouns. This student was my freshman advisee assigned to me. So I'd met the student in the very first day of the freshman year. And then he became they and took one of my writing classes and was non-binary at that point. And then eventually transitioned fully and is now a woman. But having known that young writer during the non-binary phase, when they really were neither male nor female, or perhaps were in fact both male and female, he was not accurate and she wasn't accurate. And since then, I've had quite a few non-binary students, and I could see that there was no existing pronoun that could accurately describe them. I'm a nonfiction writer. I believe in accuracy. I'm not going to call someone he or she when that person isn't exclusively he or she.
And it's also not just accuracy, it's respect.
It is respect. It is respect for someone's identity, usually not a mere preference, but a really deep sense of who one is. It was pretty easy for me to come around to the singular they with non-binary people, and a little harder for me to come around to the singular they as a general generic pronoun in situations in which gender wasn't known or in which it wasn't important. you know, all listeners, all the people who listen, you know, every person who listens to this podcast probably has a large library in their home. Now, I would at one point have said his or her home, and then I would have changed everything to the plural. All the people who listen to this podcast have large libraries in their homes. That was the workaround for a while. But now I'll just say, you know, each one has one in their home. It no longer sounds wrong to me. It did for a long time. I was really reluctant to use the singular they in that way for years after the non-binary singular they seemed completely right. But I've come around, and I even deliberately then used the generic singular they a number of times in another essay with a little footnote saying, I've used it, I don't know, 27 times or whatever, you know, I dare you to count them, so that people would understand that my evolution had continued.
Yeah, and in fact, you realized that you had been using that from time to time. Maybe when you were writing, you would do it differently, but in conversation, I mean, I tend to be a prescriptivist too, in the sense that, you know, it really bothers me when people say, you know, confuse the lie and the lay and things of that kind. But that singular they, you know, in their home, I just have naturally used it because it was so useful. We don't really, as you say in this, English is incredibly gendered, and sometimes it just trips you up.
Yeah, it's just so weird that it's such a gendered language. And I gave the example of my very beloved late father-in-law, who in his later years, when referring to his youngest son, Mark, would first cycle through the three older sons, you know, Harry, Georgie, Nettie, but then he would cycle through two male dogs before he would get to Marky. So species actually trumped gender. That is, or rather, the gender trumped species is what I mean. That is, it was so, he would be more likely to linguistically confuse his son with a male dog than with a female member of the family. And I thought, whoa, I guess that's how human beings think. That is ridiculous. That's insane. Why do we do that? So I now use they quite a bit, but I had never used it in published writing until the essays in this book. So now I've outed myself. And so the prescriptivists of the world may be shaking their fingers at me.
Yeah, I remember a long time ago I interviewed a pair of linguists who had written a book, and they were fierce descriptivists. I mean, they just thought the prescriptivists were, you know, just fuddy-duddies, you know, language is meant to be changed. But you make the point, and I think it is an important one, that to a certain degree, you want clarity in language, and that is why we do have certain rules.
Of course, the singular they can also create lack of clarity. Another person that I quote in this essay is my brother, who is not fond of the singular they, but of course he's not a college professor. He doesn't spend his life with people who are 20 years old. But anyway, he said, but if somebody said they killed them, how do I know whether one person killed one person, 100 person killed people, killed one person killed 100 people? How the hell do I know? And I thought, okay, you know, you got a point there.
So I wanted to ask you, across these essays, you, as I said in the beginning, you repeatedly reveal kind of the unexpected worlds that are hidden inside ordinary things, you know, like a household frog who's a pet, or a pronoun in a sentence. Do you think that the essay form is uniquely suited to uncovering these hidden layers of meaning?
Yes. One of the best things about essays, aside from the fact that they're fairly short, is that nobody makes money from them. That is, it's simply impossible to put ramen on the table by writing essays. And therefore, you might as well write them about what you're really interested in. Whereas there are many other genres in which you might very reasonably be tempted to ask, gee, you know, what is there a market for? What are people going to buy? I mean, there's really no market for 6,000-word essays on deceased pet frogs. There's no niche out there that I was trying to reach. And therefore, I could write about the things that truly interested me. They are often small, but I would not say that they're trivial. That is, there's an essay about an obsolete laser printer that I used to own, and that it was about our why are we attached to obsolete office equipment? Why do we stubbornly try to fix it instead of replacing it? And, you know, I wouldn't have written that essay at age 30. And clearly I identified with that printer and hoped that I could keep on being refurbished myself and not be, you know, replaced and taken to the dump. So I often, my second essay collection was called At Large and At Small. And the idea being I'm interested in a lot of different things. I'm at large in the world, but my focus is often kind of miniaturist. I also love to move from the large to the small in my essays, but I am very interested in writing about things that other people haven't noticed and trying to pay close attention to them myself and simply having the luxury of indulging things that I'm passionately obsessed with and just keeping my fingers crossed that I can make other people interested in them, even though they didn't really know that they were interested in dead frogs before they read the essay.
Well, of course, also the language that you use, the language with which you write them, which is delightful. I mean, there's a sense of humor that you bring to the writing that instead of course, does not trivialize it, but actually makes the things that you write about more poignant.
Well, I do feel that the line between humor and tragedy is a lot thinner than and blurrier than most people think. Just a couple weeks ago, I wrote on the board in front of my writing class in first person, writing a quote from the 18th century French playwright and famous spy, Pierre Beaumarchais. And it was something like, I laugh for fear of having to cry. And I do feel that the two emotions are very, very close. And I often will move from one to the other, usually laughing first before crying in an essay. That feels like a natural progression for me.
Well, they're charming essays, more than charming. They're thought-provoking and really were a joy to read. The book is Frog, and it's been just great to talk with you and Fatiman about it.
Thank you so much, Francesca. It's always wonderful to meet another Oakling, another either current or former prescriptivist, and another bibliophile. So I think you and I have plenty in common. I loved every minute. Thank you.
And Fatiman. Find a link to an excerpt from Frog at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests. You can find our social media links there, too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.